for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara-Byrne. And on this Friday night, any of us who's ever been let go from a job knows that there is no easy way to hear that news, no easy way to deliver it. But as we move towards more work being done remotely, we're also seeing what could be called an unfortunate trend towards more and more impersonal layoffs. So what should we make of things such as virtual firings on Zoom? Is there a better way? We find out. As family, friends, colleagues, and Canadians prepare to pay tribute and say farewell to Prime Minister Brian Mulroney at a state funeral in Montreal on Saturday, his eldest son, Ben, joins me to talk about memories of his father and about a very special tribute that he's producing and hosting that will air across the Chorus Radio Network on Saturday afternoon, featuring music, his conversations with everyone from Bill Clinton to Michael Bublé and Wayne Gretzky. But first, after months of speculation about what was happening behind the scenes, Catherine, the Princess of Wales, today revealed she'd been diagnosed with cancer earlier this year and has begun preventative chemotherapy. In a two-minute video posted to social media, the 42-year-old explains the shock of that diagnosis and the struggle that she and husband William had trying to explain it to their three children. We speak with a writer and cancer survivor about what she saw in that video, a cancer doctor about the diagnosis and the treatment that Catherine is undergoing, and to the Canadian Cancer Society about Catherine using the video to reach out to others living with cancer with a message of support and hope. Let's begin this evening with this developing story around the health of Catherine, the Princess of Wales. The 42-year-old has been the subject of rampant and sometimes malicious speculation about her whereabouts, the state of her marriage, her health, and much more over the past weeks and months. Well, today she released a video statement to explain exactly what's been going on behind the scenes since she underwent that major abdominal surgery back in January. The two-minute recording, filmed in Windsor on Wednesday, was made public late today, UK time. It shows Catherine sitting on a bench in a garden, and in many ways, it was very informal. But in the most crucial of ways, her words were anything but. Have a listen.
I wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you personally for all the wonderful messages of support and for your understanding whilst I've been recovering from surgery. It has been an incredibly tough couple of months for our entire family, but I've had a fantastic medical team who have taken great care of me, for which I'm so grateful. In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London, and at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I'm now in the early stages of that treatment. This, of course, came as a huge shock, and William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family. As you can imagine, this has taken time. It has taken me time to recover from major surgery in order to start my treatment. But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte and Louis in a way that's appropriate for them and to reassure them that I'm going to be okay. As I've said to them, I am well and getting stronger every day by focusing on the things that will help me heal in my mind, body and spirit. Having William by my side is a great source of comfort and reassurance too, as is the love, support and kindness that has been shown by so many of you. It means so much to us both. We hope that you'll understand that as a family, we now need some time, space and privacy while I complete my treatment. My work has always brought me a deep sense of joy, and I look forward to being back when I'm able. But for now, I must focus on making a full recovery. At this time, I'm also thinking of all those whose lives have been affected by cancer. For everyone facing this disease, in whatever form, please do not lose faith or hope. You are not alone.
A very heartfelt message released by the Princess of Wales late today. As she explains, it was thought that at the outset that her condition was non-cancerous, but that later changed, and she is in the early stages of a preventative course of chemotherapy. She did not identify the specific type of cancer she is facing. Of course, everyone who's watched that would immediately think of her children. George, Charlotte, and Louis are 10, 8, and 6. And she explained that it was a shock, a huge shock for herself and for William and for the entire family to receive this news. And of course, it comes just a few months after her father-in-law, King Charles, also revealed a cancer diagnosis. Joining me now is Pamela Raffalo Grossman. She is a writer and editor in New York City. She focuses on issues related to women's health. She's also co-edited an anthology of essays by women who've had cancer. She too is a cancer survivor and volunteers in the areas of patient advocacy and support. Pamela, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you very much.
You know, I've watched that video several times today, but I was really interested to know how it looked through your eyes.
Gosh, this is all very new news for all of us, so I'm still absorbing it. I truly didn't think that's where this story was going, so I'm quite surprised. But many of my survivor friends, and I agree with this, have said something like, "I know that look." she looks very, of course, beautiful and composed as always. But in this case, like she's trying very much to be. There are times when we feel calm naturally, and there are times when we really have to fight very hard to look like we're keeping it together. And she had that second look. That's definitely something that jumped out at me, that this is a woman who's trying really hard to be, you know, to feel okay inwardly and to put out an appearance of being okay.
Yeah. And brave too.
For sure. Yeah, very much so, because, you know, she's always been under so much scrutiny, and never more so than in the last few months. And yeah, this is a very difficult time for anyone, let alone someone so famous, let alone someone so much in the public eye, and let alone someone who's delivering news that's a very big surprise to pretty much anyone who's ever heard of her, which is most people.
Yeah, the most photographed woman in the world, right? I was watching it. It was interesting too, because I was there when she emerged with George many years ago. I watched her, you know, I think we all watched her get married. We've sort of seen her go through every stage of life. And yet right. To watch this, you know, it just reminded me that, you know, first and foremost, she's a mom. You know, this is her family.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's I'm imagining that on top of all her other concerns and thoughts at this time, she's scared. She's scared for herself, and she's probably scared for her young children. I mean, this is a very, very scary time, and when you've got little people who are depending on you for so many things, it, you know, your thoughts turn to how am I going to manage this for them? And, you know, your mind doesn't even want to go there, but what if I get sicker? You know, what about my children? Sure. Everybody who has kids or any loved ones really who depend upon them, but certainly, you know, small children, it's harder to explain. So everybody has those kinds of thoughts.
Yeah, I know from reading about you that it's such a, it feels like it should be such a personal decision, the way you reveal it, who you reveal it to. I guess in her case, I don't know whether she felt like her hand was forced, but it felt like perhaps she wasn't in a situation where she could decide when and how to share this news.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that's something that a lot of people who gave this any thought are considering today. I mean, what happened here? Why has this narrative been what it's been? And I'm certainly asking that question. And I can't say I have the answer. It's all been, for me, more questions than answers along the way. And even up to this news, I still have questions. Not so much about what's going on, but the things leading up to it, why did they happen that way? I don't understand the family photo that was rejected and found to have been, you know, whatever it was, you know, doctored together and so on, that the AP rejected it and other photo agencies. I don't understand why that happened. You know, King Charles was diagnosed so strangely right around the same time, and either he or his comms team, whoever was in charge of it, they handled it in a certain way with a statement about his cancer a long time ago. And, you know, why didn't it go that way for her? And it feels like the ways that things were handled just led to a lot of confusion, and the confusion led to speculation. And I think most of the people who were asking questions about it actually were motivated by, is this person okay? Is she safe? Like, you know, what is the truth here? And is the truth that she, you know, that she could be in any dangerous situation? I mean, not that we could really do anything about it, but people felt concerned for her on a human level. Is she okay? And, you know, this cancer news, I think, is not what people were mostly anticipating, but there was a lot of concern for her about her safety overall because of the confusion of the messages that were out there. But it occurs to me, King Charles, of course, has grown children. She has small children. Maybe that's why it was handled differently. Some people are saying that they just didn't want to make a statement while their children were in school, and that this might be the beginning of the spring vacation for them. So maybe the timing is as simple as that, that she wasn't able to make a statement because she wanted to wait for her children to be on vacation. I'm not sure, but that would make some sense, I guess.
Yeah, it might resonate with those who know how those who had to share this news with their kids.
Right, right. And, you know, there's never an easy way. There's never a good time. You know, you don't want to tell your children. You don't want to tell your parents. You don't want to tell any of your loved ones because it's horrible news, and you know that you're going to be delivering upon them something that nobody wants to hear. It's extremely difficult, and I would imagine there's no way to handle it perfectly.
Pamela Ruffalo Grossman is with us this half hour. She's a writer and editor in New York. She's a cancer survivor who volunteers in the areas of patient advocacy and support. We're talking about Kate, the Princess of Wales, announcing a cancer diagnosis today. She released a video that was shot earlier this week that explained what had happened. She's undergoing a round of preventative chemotherapy right now. Pamela, I suppose just going back to that video and the words that she used about needing to take the time now to just take care of herself, I suppose that must have resonated as well.
Yes, absolutely. I think millions of people worldwide have been thinking about this news and thinking about the video and, you know, wherever it takes them with their own history or their families or loved ones or whatever it may be. And yes, of course, as a cancer survivor, it made me think about my own cancer experiences, and certainly my own experiences in having to tell the people in my life and figure out how to do that. Fortunately, I wasn't under nearly the public pressure that Princess Catherine has been, and in this particular situation of having to disclose cancer, I'm especially glad about that. But yes, it's hard no matter what. Telling people who you love and who love you is very hard. Discussing it in the beginning when you don't know what's going on, but you have to try to explain it to someone else is very hard. There's one thing that keeps jumping out at me, though, about her experience and the way that her experience has been presented in the last couple of months. You don't really know, you know, when you share this news, you don't, there's a lot you don't know. You're going to give the best information that you can to your loved ones and just go from there. There's a lot you don't know, but something that I think is at least an unspoken rule is that you don't give information that is incorrect. You don't not tell the truth or put information out there to your loved ones or to the world that is not true. And I think that's something that a lot of people are thinking about with this Catherine experience, and I'm thinking about. It appears that they put things out into the public that were not true, and it's hard to understand why that happened. That is something with the disclosure of any important event or any important circumstance that you just don't do. You don't put information out that isn't true. And so that's just something I've been thinking about.
Yeah. Well, Pamela, thank you so much for your insight on this. And you're well, I gather.
Oh, yes. And thank you for asking. We're some wood to knock. Yes, I did my treatment. I started just around this same time of the year. So if Catherine is just starting chemo, then that will be right around when I did, but in 2008. And I've been cancer-free since that time, and very gratefully so, of course.
Pamela, I'm great to hear, and thank you so much for sharing that tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We continue with that developing story, Catherine, the Princess of Wales, revealing late today, UK time, in a two-minute video statement that she'd been diagnosed with cancer after undergoing serious abdominal surgery earlier this year. The 42-year-old royal has been subject of much speculation over the past few months. She explained in the video that she is in the early stages of a preventative course of chemotherapy. That video was filmed on Wednesday in Windsor and made public late today, UK time. Here's some of it.
The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I'm now in the early stages of that treatment. This, of course, came as a huge shock, and William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family.
Of course, her children, George is 10, Charlotte 8, Louis 6. And much like the king who revealed his cancer diagnosis and treatment earlier this year, she did not identify the specific type of cancer that she is facing.
It has taken me time to recover from major surgery in order to start my treatment. But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte and Louis in a way that's appropriate for them and to reassure them that I'm going to be okay.
Well, joining me now is Dr. Keith Stewart. He's director of the Princess Margaret Cancer Center. Dr. Stewart, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Oh, you're welcome. Good evening.
I guess just to understand medically what the princess was explaining today, this notion of what perhaps they found and the whole idea of preventative chemotherapy.
Well, it sounds from what I've read that she underwent procedure to, I suspect, to remove a mass in her abdomen is, of course, there's a lot of organs in the abdomen that this could have affected, but at her age and condition, one would be a bit suspicious of the ovaries and endometrium, for example. And I suspect she went under surgery to remove what was initially thought to be a benign lesion. But subsequently, on pathology review, there were some signs of early malignancy in that resected sample.
Right. And then this preventative chemo, that standard procedure when that happens?
Well, for example, if you have an early ovarian cancer and there's been surgery, if the surgeons are confident that they've removed everything, but there's some evidence that giving some chemotherapy might provide further reassurance against or further insurance against regrowth or recurrence in clinical trials, then certainly using chemotherapy in that setting is fairly common these days.
Right. I suppose, as she mentioned, she would have to have recovered from that initial surgery before this would happen.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, the wound would have to heal. She has to digest this and speak to her family. The physicians would normally, in a cancer diagnosis today, wait for more sophisticated molecular testing to determine exactly what kind of cancer she had and what treatment was most appropriate. And then after a period of I would assume 6 to 8 weeks post-surgery, one would start the chemotherapy, as it sounds, it's about the timing that's happened here.
Right. And that might go some ways in explaining why there's been so little information as well. She mightn't have known exactly what it was that she was facing.
She may not have known for a week or two afterwards. I wonder, of course, who knows? We don't even know what organ this is affecting, but the surgeons may have been somewhat suspicious at the time of the operation, or it may have just taken looking under the microscope to find evidence of malignancy. I suspect that there was uncertainty before she underwent her surgery. I mean, modern-day scanning is quite good. We can often tell in advance, but it sounds in this case that it wasn't clear. And it may have taken a week to get the pathology back. It may have taken another week to get molecular testing back. And then, of course, this is a young woman with a very upsetting diagnosis. She has to speak to her family, and in her high-profile situation, of course, decide how to break this news to the public.
Right. Is your sense that that this would have been caught early? Is this an early diagnosis situation?
It sounds like it. Usually, if there's an early malignancy, one is interested to whether it's localized, encapsulated, or whether there's evidence it's spread into the local lymph nodes, for example. And that would determine both the treatment, the duration of treatment, and, of course, the prognosis. But it sounds very much like this was caught early, and ovarian cancer, well, for many cancers that are caught early, the prognosis is actually quite good, and this may well be curative in her case, one would hope.
Yeah. Some difficult times ahead, I suppose, now that she's begun this preventative treatment?
Well, no chemotherapy is easy. Fortunately, these days, it's getting a lot better as we move to more molecular targeted therapies. But for some of the cancers, one gets the abdomen. It's still chemotherapy that can come with hair loss, fatigue, nausea, and other side effects. So this will be a difficult time for her, particularly with young family and being in the heat of the media attention.
Right. 42. I mean, I think we often think of cancer impacting older people. She's young. I know this is not unheard of, obviously, but still, 42 years old, is that uncommon?
It is. It is. I mean, as you say, cancer is generally a disease of aging for many cancer types, chronic inflammation. 42 is young, obviously upsettingly so in this case, but for women, breast cancer, ovarian cancer do unfortunately occur in women at this young age. Often in this situation, we would test to see if there's any family predisposition that she was born with. It turns out up to 10 to 20% of people at this age with an early cancer will have been born at increased risk, and I suspect that's something they'll be looking at.
Where to then from here? I know that probably the most important thing now is for people to simply leave the family alone and sort of let her go through this process. But I can only imagine, and we spoke to a cancer survivor just before you, about just how scary a time this is.
Yeah, it's very difficult, of course. And you know, the side effects of treatment make things even more difficult for patients to get through. But fortunately, in the case of preventive therapy, it's usually fairly short-lived. Again, not knowing the cancer type or how widespread it was. We think it's localized, of course, but we don't know. It could be anywhere from as little as 2 to 3 months up to 6 months, but it will probably be over at that point, hopefully cured. Scans will be performed to make sure that's the case, and one would hope that. And the cure rate for many of these cancers is quite high. It can be 70 to 90% cure rates if it's very localized. So I think she has good prospects for cure from what I've determined from just reading the media like you.
Mm-hmm. Well, she certainly spoke. I mean, she mentioned in the video that she told her kids that, you know, that trying to explain how she would be okay. But I suppose there's a lot of things. I would imagine you advise on this as well, that sharing this news with kids, sharing this news with the family, let alone sharing this news with the world, can be pretty daunting.
It is daunting, but we do encourage families to share. We find it becomes more difficult, not just for the patient, but for their family, not to discuss it and get out in the open, particularly when there might be physical appearance changes. I don't know what treatment Catherine is receiving, but if it's, you know, chemotherapy that causes hair loss, for example, that would be very obvious to the family and to our children in particular. And it's much better, I think, that they're forewarned. As long as they understand that while there's risk, there's also a lot of reason for hope and optimism, I think it's probably the wise thing to do to discuss with families. There are cultures in which this has been a bit more taboo over the years, but gradually we're sort of seeing that breakdown and people are more openly discussing it. And one of the values of Charles and Catherine going public, of course, is it does build awareness. It does lead to conversation. It does destigmatize the condition. So all of those are very helpful, I think, in the broader sense.
Yeah, her final words, the final part of that video was, in fact, that was the message. She was speaking to other people living with cancer out there about not being alone. And that felt like a very powerful part of what she had to say.
Well, they certainly have the soapbox to do that on. And I think they can, you know, if they can encourage others in the same situation, the same age groups, other cancer patients with young children, that, you know, this can happen to anyone. It's not something they did wrong. It's a fairly random event in many cases. And just to reassure them that they are, as you say, not alone. And, you know, she's fortunate to live in a good country like the United Kingdom with great cancer care, just like Canada, and a lot of hope.
Yeah, I suppose there'll be a lot of clamoring for updates and so on, but what would be a proper timeline, do you think, then, for how this will unfold for the princess?
Yeah, it's a little surprising to me they didn't, say what type of cancer it was. I mean, I think we can speculate, and there may be reasons for that, but I suspect we will learn in due time. But I was a little surprised they just didn't come out and say this is what she's dealing with, given that there's been a lot of speculation already and you know, even some strange theories. Certainly when King Charles came out with his diagnosis of prostate cancer, I think it was quite clarifying. And then you could speak with more legitimacy and knowledge on what the actual prognosis, likely treatments, outcomes, and educate the public a little bit about that particular type of cancer. For now, there's a lot of things it could be. I think most of us have narrowed it down in our minds to the most likely things, but we just don't know right now.
Right. Well, Dr. Stewart, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
At this time, I'm also thinking of all those whose lives have been affected by cancer. For everyone facing this disease, in whatever form, please do not lose faith or hope. You are not alone.
That was Catherine, the Princess of Wales, in a video statement she released earlier today, UK time, revealing that she had a cancer diagnosis after that major abdominal surgery she underwent in early January, and that she'd begun a round of preventative chemotherapy after recovering from that surgery. But it was those final words that were where she sort of reached out to other people in her situation that really stuck with me in many ways. I mean, the whole video is quite touching and heartfelt about, you know, how big a shock it was breaking the news to her family, worrying about her children and so on. But she did say in those final few words of that 2-minute video that others living with cancer should not lose faith or hope, saying you are not alone. It was a reminder that, well, as a royal family, William and Catherine have been in the public eye through their courtship, wedding, the birth of their kids, the death of the queen, their father, the king's, the king ascending to the throne, and beyond. This is the story of one family living through something that all too many Canadians know all too well. Of course, the king revealed his own cancer diagnosis earlier this year. So now it's hit that family in such an intimate way. If you look at the Canadian numbers alone, in 2023, it was estimated that an average of 655 Canadians or people in Canada were diagnosed with cancer every single day. Joining me now is Sandra Krukel. She's Executive Vice President of Mission Information and Support Services with the Canadian Cancer Society. Sandra, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure, Ben. Thank you for asking me to be on your show.
Yeah, I guess we spoke was when the king revealed his diagnosis. And here we are. I mean, I suppose in many ways that it's a reminder that, you know, cancer doesn't recognize social status. It doesn't recognize fame. It doesn't recognize any barriers.
No, it sure doesn't. It definitely, I mean, who would have thought just in such a short time the same family would have been facing another cancer diagnosis, but it does happen to many families, and it isn't an unusual circumstance. As you said, over 600 people are diagnosed every day, and 2 out of 5 of us in our lifetime will face our own personal cancer diagnosis. So it is sadly not a surprise, although such a huge hardship for this family.
What did you make of her words of support? Because clearly a lot of it was just about her personal situation and the sort of the shock of receiving the diagnosis, trying to figure out how to break that news to the rest, to the kids and so on. But at the end, she did save a spot to try to reach out to others in the same situation. I thought that was quite touching.
Mm-hmm. It's very lovely because it's a moment of such personal hardship, and especially with such a young family as they have and being so in the public eye. But it was a very lovely and thoughtful moment for her to pause and just recognize that she isn't the only one in this circumstance. There are so many people around the world facing cancer. And in fact, that, you know, you are not alone is such a beautiful sentiment to be sharing when we are in hardship, because when we are in hardship is when we need community and we need support and care.
Right. And to not give up hope either, because yeah. You know, it would be, yeah, it was easy to watch that video and try to figure out what must be going through her mind. We had a cancer survivor off the top of the show who said, you know, they had that they recognized that look of uncertainty that she had, trying to keep it together. But just, you know, this is the unknown can be a really terrifying place.
Yeah, it can be. And, you know, you certainly have to feel a lot of compassion for them because of the public nature of their roles, that it's very hard to have privacy in their circumstance. But so lovely of her to be thinking about the fact that many people are facing this, and to use the platform that she does have to reach out and to say you are not alone, and to express care and compassion for others who are in the same situation as her.
How important is it then? We spoke about this when we talked of the King's diagnosis and him going public with it, and now Kate doing Catherine doing the same thing, just to raise awareness. I mean, these are people that that are listened to, and certainly Catherine is someone who I think, for better or worse, a lot of people feel like they know very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is really important because it, I mean, just as it did with the King sharing his news, it does make all of us pause for a moment and think about our own health and our own situations and the health of our loved ones, and remind us that it, you know, cancer doesn't know boundaries, and you can live a very healthy lifestyle and you can do all the good things and have, in fact, a lot of privilege, as the royal family certainly does, and still it can happen. And so we each need to be thinking about regular screening for cancer and ensuring that we are doing the things that we can do to reduce the likelihood of cancer, and knowing and understanding our, you know, family history and all the things that might contribute to each of our own, you know, individual risk when it comes to cancer.
Right. I was mentioning earlier, of course, Catherine is 42. I think a lot of people might, when we look at cancer statistics, you know, most are older. In this case, she's a young woman in many ways. And I suppose this is also a reminder that younger people need to be aware of this as well.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And you know, it's why it's important to pay attention and know your body. Know when there are things that just are off, and make sure that you are talking to your doctor about any unusual symptoms that persist, so that you can assess whether there is something there that needs further investigation.
Yeah. Well, Sandra, as always, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks very much.
The final preparations are wrapping up this evening ahead of the state funeral for Prime Minister Brian Mulroney at Notre Dame Basilica in Montreal on Saturday. Today, he once again lay in repose in Montreal's St. Patrick's Basilica, another chance for Canadians from all walks of life to come and pay tribute to Mr. Mulroney and pay their respects to his family. And from the lying in state in Ottawa earlier this week through today, his family have been there greeting faces familiar and not, listening to stories and memories shared. Mulroney's son, Mark, says the family's decision to spend 4 days accepting condolences from the public was inspired by their mother, Mila Mulroney.
My mom just doesn't want to be not by my dad's side, and we're following my mom. And my mom heard that there were people waiting out in the cold, and she said, well, I'd like to greet them. And it just kind of happened organically that way.
Yeah. By Thursday evening, almost 3,000 people, according to the Globe and Mail, in Ottawa and Montreal had come to pay their respects, with members of the Mulroney family greeting each and every one of them. That personal touch, of course, a real tribute to Mr. Mulroney in of itself. Well, it will be on display on Saturday's state funeral as well. His eldest son, Ben, says he and his family hope the celebration of his father's life, it will be seen as a celebration of his father's life as well. His eldest child, Mr. Mulroney's and only daughter, Carolyn Mulroney, will speak for the family. Prime Minister Mr. Justin Trudeau will give a eulogy, followed by Quebec media mogul Pierre-Carl Pelladeau, hockey great Wayne Gretzky, former U.S. Secretary of State James Baker, and Jean Charest as well will be giving a eulogy, his longtime political ally. And as part of the day to honor the late Prime Minister, who would have turned 85 earlier this week, and to include some of those who couldn't be there in person tomorrow, Ben Mulroney, of course, a longtime broadcaster and name and face you'll be familiar with, I'm sure, has also hosted and produced a very special two-hour tribute to his father that will air across the Chorus Radio Network on Saturday afternoon. Perhaps you've already heard a shorter version of it. It includes conversations with U.S. Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, Michael Bublé, Reba McEntire, David Foster, Wayne Gretzky as well. It is a really touching tribute, and it's full of really interesting stories from the guests that he's brought on. Ben Mulroney is with me now from Montreal. Ben, thank you so much for your time tonight. My condolences, of course.
Ben, thank you.
First, my condolences to you and the family. It's been interesting just to see you all together again in Ottawa and Montreal. What's it been like? How are you holding up? And your mom, especially.
Well, all the grandkids arrived yesterday and today. there's a certain noise level that accompanies that many people. And the noise is drowning out the sadness at this point. There's a lot to be thankful for. There's a lot to be happy about. There's a lot to celebrate and remember. And I don't think that we are going to fit in that sadness until we have some quiet moments. And those are still a while off.
It's been interesting to see all the people. I mean, there's obviously been all the dignitaries, and it says so much about, I mean, I interviewed your dad quite a few times over the years, and it says so much about him that, you know, I was talking to Bill McCarthy yesterday, who is his longtime personal photographer. Yeah. One of his heads of security was first in line when he was lying in state in Ottawa. You know, there's that old saying that you can always tell a lot about someone about how they treat people who serve them or work with them. And I think that's such a testament to your dad that so many who worked with him and for him have turned out this week really emotionally as well, and very much saddened and wanting to pay their respects.
Dad was the son of an electrician from the Quebec North Shore. And not only did he never forget it, but it was absolutely central to his identity. There's no reality in which my father was going to have anybody who worked for him feel like they were that he was any better than him or them, because they all came from the same place as far as he was concerned. And so that his kindness stems from his upbringing, and his upbringing brought him from Quebec, the Quebec North Shore, to, you know, all over New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, and then ultimately Montreal and Ottawa. It's who he was. It's who he was. And I'm so glad that people are remembering him that way.
How about just for you? And Miss, I mean, you've lost a father. I think people understand that, and they watch you and your brothers and your sister and your mom, and they think of that, the loss that it's been for the family. But you must have heard some really great stories from people this week that must be a beautiful reminder that of how much of an impact he had on not just your life, but so many others.
Oh, we've heard every type of story. We've heard, I met a guy who had my dad's dorm room at St. Francis Xavier University. I met a guy who said that my dad was the reason he went into tax law, which I thought was, I don't know how you think that sounds, but that certainly makes me chuckle a little bit. I had a woman who stopped by who said, I didn't vote for your dad. I never wanted to vote for your dad, but I'm here to tell you that I made a mistake.
Oh, wow.
And then there are young people. Oh, we've had people from, especially here in Quebec, we've had people from France who said, I didn't know anything about your father until I came to Canada. And then I heard about his passing a few weeks ago, and I've read up on him. And it's because of what I read about him that made me want to come here and honor him. And, you know, stories of decisions that his government made that made someone's life better, or a phone call that somebody got. These are all sort of bricks in a beautiful wall. And I'm proud to watch that wall be erected.
It was his birthday this week, would have been his 85th birthday. And I know there was a poll out about sort of his favorability. And you and your brother, I think, went to share that with him, which was a really beautiful moment, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, he did. Listen, when he said that he didn't govern for polls, he meant it. Some people thought that that was some sort of hedge or some sort of, you know, reverse engineering of justification as to why his poll numbers were low, but he didn't care about them. Political capital is you have political capital to spend it on big things, is what he used to say. And, you know, he said, I don't govern for better poll numbers in 30 days. I govern for a better Canada in 30 years. Well, we're 30 years removed from the decisions that he made. I don't know a person worth their salt who would say that Canada is not better for the decisions that he made and for the swings that he took. So I'm very, very proud that poll came out, because it tells me that he was right. And a lot of the people who were upset with some of the decisions that he made, didn't like the decisions he made back then, appreciate that in the fullness of time, the reasoning behind them was proven right.
You know, the brief amount of time I spent with your father, one thing that maybe was underappreciated about him, I think, sometimes in the general public because of who he was, or who he'd been as prime minister, was just how funny he was, just how incredibly funny he was. And any time you spent with him, you didn't walk away without a good laugh.
Oh, yeah. Well, but one of the things he used to say when his numbers were very low, I don't know that this joke holds up anymore because it's not a reflection of reality. But when his numbers were low, he'd get in front of a group, and he'd say, you know, the one thing I miss about politics, and then he would take a good old fashioned Irish pregnant pause, the adulation. Huh. It would always bring the house down.
Yeah, he liked to be. He was happy to be the target of his own humor too. That self-effacing side was, and you said that within the family, he was often the butt of your jokes in the most loving of ways.
Oh, he loved it when we would tell stories about things that he had done. So long as it's in the family and we're around the dinner table, we loved making him laugh. We loved making him laugh. He would laugh from the belly outward. He would laugh with his whole body. It was a great joy that we had to spend as much time with him as we did.
I remember when he popped up at the table when we were visiting up in Canada and started singing. I said, "Oh my God, what is this guy up to?" And all of a sudden, he not only could he carry a tune, but he's a really good singer. And it was clear that he loved to sing and he loved to project through song. Frankly, I was amazed.
Ben Mulrooney is with me this half hour. It's my great pleasure to have him here the day before the state funeral for his father tomorrow, which will, of course, be an emotional day for the whole family. They've been there all week as he lay in state in Ottawa and then lay in repose now in Montreal. And tomorrow, of course, is the funeral. Ben's put together, sort of reached out and done some of what he does best and put together a really interesting and special tribute to his dad by speaking to people who knew him from different walks, from just different people from entertainment and politics and so on. Ben, that must have been a really interesting experience for you, because it's work you know how to do well and you're great at, but you had this, you had to sort of reach out to people. How did you come up with the list of people you thought would be the right mix to speak to about your father?
Well, and first of all, thank you for saying all those kind things. It was something that we as the family decided as a group, that we wanted to tell a story that maybe no one else could tell, but that would probably be appreciated. And we wanted to tell a personal story so that it would resonate beyond anyone's feelings about my father. You know, if somebody else was dealing with loss, then there might be something in there for them to latch onto to make them feel better. The list came together based on, you know, a lot of people are quite busy. Not everyone can make it to every event. And so when we heard that President Bush and President Clinton would not be able to come to the funeral, I asked them, my follow-up was, would you participate in this tribute? They jumped at the chance to participate. And David Foster did his best to show up, Reba McEntire, Michael Bublé. But when you're at the top of your game and as successful as they are, you're committed years in advance. But they wanted to show their appreciation of my father. And this was an avenue that we opened up for them. The only person who's doing both is Wayne Gretzky.
Right.
We had dinner with him in Florida. And he said, whatever you need from me. I said, well, would you? He said, he asked to speak at the funeral. He said, yes. But then I tempted fate. And I said, would you also be part of this? And he said, 100%. So that's how the list came together.
It must have been both difficult and so edifying for you to be able to do that, because it would be, I mean, it's still, I'm sure, all very new and raw. And yet you got to sit down with these folks and sort of talk about their memories of your dad. And I'm sure they all have memories that you mightn't even have known.
Oh, absolutely. That was what I was hoping for. They all had a perspective that was all their own, I was there as a representative of the family. But what I really wanted to do was let them tell their stories in the hopes of, like I said, introducing an aspect of my dad to people that they might not know. And in a lot of cases, the stories are of my father when the door was closed or on the other end of the telephone. And a lot of people have those stories, but not everybody does. And so I really wanted, I want to show people the man that they all knew. And I shared some of my own stories as well. And it was therapeutic and it was calming and it was sad and it was turbulent. But all things I think I probably needed to experience in order to get to the other side of grief. And I'm not there yet, and I won't be for a while, but this was certainly a step in the right direction.
I love that you brought the music into it too, because I think I've listened to your dad speak a lot over the years. He would always make jokes when he had a microphone in his hand that he was about to break out into song. And I think, you know, when we watched him sing Irish Eyes Are Smiling, all of us have that memory. We thought, oh, you know, he can sing actually. And it was really interesting for you to bring in that, because I know that music, and sometimes this is also about celebrating the man, the father, the grandfather, not just the politician, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And but the older he got, the more he loved singing. And boy, did he love singing. And we would sing with him. We would listen to music together. He put together a CD of his favorite of songs that he sang that he did as a memory that he wanted to pass on to his grandkids. And we used some of that in the special. And I've had that on my phone for the longest time. I actually had my friends transfer the CD into my Apple Music. So I've been able to listen to it on repeat. And my birthday was just a few weeks ago. I was supposed to be with him for my 48th birthday. That didn't happen. And I was sad the day before that I wouldn't speak to him on my birthday. He was always the first guy to call me. But because I had been listening to his songs so often, I woke up to one of his songs on repeat in my head. And I took that as a sign that the first voice I heard on my birthday was yet again my dad.
Yeah, you spoke about having that in so many ways. And when I know I've read interviews that you did many years ago when your kids were young, and just, you know, what a confidant and what a mentor he always was for you. And that, you know, that his voice in that way, and it was you explained this, that you'd had sort of recordings of his voice messages and his songs and so on, but his voice also lives other ways. It's remarkable just what an impact he had on you. And you know, lots of dads and sons get along well, but wow.
Yeah, no, we had a tremendous relationship. I don't think a day went by over the past year that I didn't, at least if I didn't talk to him, I certainly left him a message, and I could say the same thing for every sibling I have. And he wanted to talk to his grandkids. He was so proud of them. He was so proud of the family that was going to live beyond him. I thought that he had set us up for tremendous success, and so proud that every one of his grandkids have pictures with him, and almost all of them, because there's one or two that are still very young. They all have real memories of time spent with their grandfather. He got sick a few times in the past, and my mother, who he called his guardian angel, did everything in her power to get him to fight or to find other doctors, and was able to save him from the clutches of death, for lack of a better expression. And I reminded him of all the memories that he had since those moments. I said, were it not for mom, you would have missed the birth of X number of grandkids. You would have missed X number of graduations, X number of conversations, X number of birthdays. And we all celebrated together for his 50th wedding anniversary to my mother in Italy last year. The entire family got together for 2 weeks. That was all because of my dad. And we were fortunate enough to have that and carry that with us.
Ben, thank you so much. We'll all be standing with you in spirit tomorrow in Montreal, and look forward to hearing your tribute to your dad as well. Thank you again.
Ben, I appreciate it. All the best.
Many of us live with aches and pains. Some of them are small and easily managed. Some of them are chronic and far worse. My ankles hurt from running. Can't get rid of it. My next guest has spent years helping people find ways to manage that pain as a physiotherapist and owner of Leading Edge Physio in Alberta, both in Edmonton and Calgary, soon to be in BC as well. Grant Fedoric is bringing his expertise to the airwaves in a show called Life Shouldn't Hurt. Now, it'll already be familiar to listeners in Edmonton. He's been hosting Life Shouldn't Hurt on 630 CHED there for quite a while, but this weekend he's taking his show National on the Chorus Radio Network, airing on Saturdays, beginning on Saturday morning. And Grant joins me now from Tokyo. Thank you for your time tonight.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad you could have me on. And great tune coming in, by the way. Good vibrations. Yeah. That's a good physio song.
It is, because we were sort of thinking about songs that were about sort of everybody hurts. So I thought, no, wait a second. Grant's show isn't about hurting. Grant's show is about finding relief.
That's exactly right. And about connecting people and sharing stories and inspiring people from the people who are facing their obstacles, be it injury, pain, or disease, or even social issues. So we're doing our best to kind of just make the world a little better place, one listener at a time.
Yeah, life shouldn't hurt. You have a pretty interesting first show teed up. I understand there's sort of someone who survived a pretty scary incident that's going to be on talking about their rehabilitation, how they got through it.
Yeah, you know, and we've been pretty fortunate. I've been very fortunate in my career. I've had the opportunity to work through various problems and obstacles for people. And this is a perfect example. This was a helicopter crash survivor, somebody who faced such a huge trauma in her life, so many injuries, overcame or is still overcoming them and doing her best. And the story is fantastic. I don't want to give it all away here, but definitely listen to the show because her story is unbelievable.
Yeah, it sounds remarkable. I look forward to listening to it. What kind of calls do you get? Because people may be, because you're a physiotherapist, people may be mistaken to think that it's about sort of the usual things that people would go see you for, but it's much broader than that.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. It is. It's really about, well, people sharing their stories. So we've got many, many stories over the years and people who've kind of gone through certain things, and it's nothing better than hearing it directly from them. So it can be an injury. It can be something as mundane as a tennis elbow that is affecting somebody and keeping them from what they want to enjoy. But it's also about other things. We'll have some experts on the show, various people I've come across in my career, from physicians and specialists in their area to dietitians talking about how to live well, to, you know, charities as well, people sharing their story of what they bring to the community and maybe opening people's eyes to those things that are available to them that might help them out at the time that they're facing their obstacle in their life too.
Yeah, it's interesting how much, because I think when we first spoke a little while back on a series that we did on the show about chronic pain and just how much our idea of life shouldn't hurt has evolved over time, that there is no thing that is too small. There are no issues that you can't talk about. And you know, we're open to these, a little more open to these conversations now than we used to be in the old sort of, you know, stiff upper lip, grin and bear it days.
Yeah, and I think we've all done that. I mean, it's even evolved to the point where when we were younger, myself too, and playing sports, the number of things and obstacles that I had to overcome on my own because it was just a matter of, you know, you're a kid, it'll go away sort of a thing. Now we recognize that it might not, and there's so many things available to help people. And in my area, as far as physiotherapy goes, I'd love the opportunity to expand on these things. So we might have, for instance, a pediatrician on the show talking about injuries and various things that kids face. But then I get an opportunity to expand on it and say, from our perspective, this is what it looks like when we're kind of dealing with it as well. So it's kind of that format where we'll have an interview in the middle and then an opportunity for me to share a little bit more about it with some other experts too. Some of my team will be joining me on the show. One of my partners that's been working with me for over 15 years, Anita Cassidy, will be part of the show, and other people that I get a chance to talk to.
Yeah. And again, I wanted to, you know, you don't need to have sort of, as I think sometimes people are hesitant to call in with the tennis elbows of the world, or I was explaining that I have ankles that hurt from my running and so on, that there are no problems that are too small to sort of call in and try and get some opinions on them, because each of us, so many people will relate with what you're talking about, regardless of what exactly the person's experience is.
Yeah, and ankles is actually a perfect example I come across all the time, because people will come up to me, as you can imagine, and they'll say, I feel like I'm just bugging you, but I've had this ankle thing, and it seems so small. And then after having an opportunity to spend 3 or 4 minutes with the person and say, well, this is actually something that you can do something about, and you don't have to stop doing what you're doing, and it can be treated. Next thing you know, they're seeking treatment, whether it's with myself or another physio in the area or an expert that might solve their problem. And that's kind of what this is about, just really getting it across to an entire nation that there are things that are available to you to make a difference in your life. And you hit it on the head. I don't think there's anything too small, to be honest. If it's something that you that is keeping you from enjoying your life to its fullest, then it's something that you should take serious.
Right. I never thought you must get cornered at parties all the time.
I do, and I quite enjoy it. I always get it. Always starts with, I don't mean to bother you, but do you mind if I ask? And I always say, absolutely. For most people, they might kind of avoid those things, but I'm like, let's pull up a chair and talk about it. I can't tell you how much I enjoy what I get to do. I have a passion for it. I call it a calling because I really do every day look forward to chatting with people about their problems and seeing if we can get them over them and around them.
Yeah. I need to ask you, of course, because it is Saturday afternoon, I believe, where you are. What's it like? What's been going on? How's Japan?
You know, it's been fantastic. I love to get around the world and see what's offered in our area, but also to explore and see different people in their cultures and their environments. I truly believe it's kind of part of what the human experience is. So if I'm sitting down from across from a patient and I have an opportunity to talk about my experience in Japan, or they're from Japan or from Europe or from wherever, I just feel like it expands my ability to kind of have those conversations, connect with people and make a difference. And that's what I'm getting to do. And you call it a holiday and a great life. It is. I can't complain. Japan's been fantastic. I'm only day two here, so I'm probably going to start feeling the effects of jet lag any moment. So far, so good. It's busy, though, I'll tell you. I appreciate the prairies where I'm from because it's a little more spread out than it is here. But
yeah.
I'm getting used to it. Yeah,
I lived in Edmonton for a while, and I've been to Tokyo, and I'll tell you, those are two very different places when it comes to crowds on the streets, is how I would put it. Yeah,
that's exactly right. Or even restaurants, you know, a busy restaurant in Edmonton, you can still move around, but a busy restaurant here, you're shoulder to shoulder and back to back with people. And it's definitely a different experience. I'm enjoying it. And I can't wait to share some of those stories too with all of our listeners.
Yeah. Are the cherry blossoms out yet, or is that season done? I forget whether we're too late.
Wow. You got a great mind for this. I am landing on day one of when cherry blossoms start to kind of show up. So we got very, very fortunate. We even got fortunate with the fact that the emperor's kind of his grounds are open to the public right now. And they're only open for 1 week in the spring and 1 week in the fall. And we just kind of got lucky, landed on day one and said, as the Fedorics have it, we kind of just got to show up and experience some of these things. So it's been amazing.
Yeah. Well, Grant, listen, congratulations on the show going from, I mean, I know in Edmonton, people know you well. I'm glad we're all going to get a chance to listen to it out here in BC and across Canada as well. Congratulations. And I look forward to the first episode nationally of Life Shouldn't Hurt, because it shouldn't.
Absolutely. I can't wait to get a chance to meet you in person and have some of these conversations ourselves. I think you have so much to share, and I appreciate you as well.
Enjoy your trip. Have a great time. Safe travels, as always.
Yeah, thanks for having me today.
We'll continue tonight with that developing story about Catherine, the Princess of Wales, and that video she released to social media late today, UK time, in which she revealed that she'd been diagnosed with cancer, that she's undergoing preventative chemotherapy, as she called it. This all happened after she underwent serious abdominal surgery earlier this year. She said she's in the very early stages of this chemotherapy. She spoke about the shock, having to share that news with their three children. Of course, George, Charlotte, and Louis are 10, 8, and 6, so still a very young family. The difficulty and the support that William has been giving her. Here's some of that two-minute video that she shared this afternoon.
The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I'm now in the early stages of that treatment. This, of course, came as a huge shock, and William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family.
Much like the King, of course, who revealed his cancer diagnosis and treatment earlier this year, Kate did not identify the type of cancer that she is facing. The 42-year-old has been the subject, of course, of rampant and sometimes malicious speculation about her whereabouts, the state of her marriage, her health, and much more over the past weeks and months. Royal commentator Jenny Bond says the video shared online today should end that speculation.
her very brave to make a video message like that. She didn't have to, but she did that partly because I think of all the ridiculous, absurd theories that have been going around on the internet. And that really is my second thought. It is that I hope that those social media trolls who have peddled such ghastly, hurtful theories will now realize what they've done and be absolutely ashamed of themselves.
Indeed. Freelance royal correspondent and longtime BuzzFeed royal reporter Ellie Hall joins me now. Thanks for your time tonight.
Thank you for having me.
I guess just your reaction. I know that, you know, I was struck by the video itself, just watching it, how heartfelt and simple it was in so many ways.
It was something that I know absolutely nobody saw coming. No one expected this. And it's part of, you know, you have to kind of wonder if she would have felt it was necessary to do this, if things had gone differently, if perhaps the public relations team had rolled things out in a different way. But it was very, very heartfelt. And I don't think anyone who watched it came away with anything except sympathy, you know, for this 42-year-old mother of three who lives a life of public service. And after all of this speculation and all of this time, we find out that it's something really serious. So yeah, it was a very emotional, I think, for everyone who watched it.
Yeah. And there's been so much talk about whether it was felt that maybe she had been bullied in some way into doing this, that in fact, this wasn't, the timing of this was not her own decision. And she explained it quite well within the video itself, sort of saying, I needed to find a way to tell my kids about this.
Yeah. And that makes complete and utter and perfect sense. I mean, I do think that amidst all of this speculation, it might have gotten a little easy to forget that a public figure is also an actual person. But at the same time, you know, I keep coming back to this. You look at how Buckingham Palace, which is the King and Queen's press team, handled the rollout of his cancer diagnosis and how they've been able to keep him enough in the public eye so that people are reassured. You really do wonder if there was any sort of way that Kate's press team could have made fewer mistakes and could have helped her be able to share this news in a way that she was comfortable with, that, you know, didn't have to lead to her being on camera talking to all of us. I mean, maybe that was what she wanted to do, but just looking at how the King's news was shared with us, it's very, very different. And I think a lot of people are feeling a little sheepish right now, wondering if media coverage, if social media gossip, things like that pushed her to do something that she wasn't comfortable with.
Yeah, I mean, just in the long history of the royal family and talking about health matters, I mean, certainly the Queen and Prince Philip, I covered this quite a bit back when, and, you know, there was very little news about it. And it's just been, with Charles's, with the King's diagnosis as well recently, I mean, this has been a unprecedented time for the royal family. And I think we're witnessing, in any family, this would be a really difficult time with Charles's cancer diagnosis, now with Kate's as well. And I guess we're watching in real time a family, even if they're a public family, struggling with how to share this news.
Oh, without a doubt. And you are correct in that this is different than how the royal family normally operates. I mean, there have been many rumors about the cause of the Queen's death and the cause of Prince Philip's death, but we never saw the palace release any information about that. And this is a sea change in terms of the King. Obviously, neither the King nor Kate have identified what type of cancer they have, and that's their right. They can absolutely keep that medical information private. And I hope for their sake that, since that's obviously their wish, that it's able to stay private. But this is very different than how the royal family normally operates, by giving us this information, by letting us in, and by really talking to us one-on-one. Kate was talking to the world in that video. She wasn't just talking to people of the United Kingdom. She was talking to everybody around the world who, in some way or another, have been worried about her. That's something that's been at the heart of all of these conspiracy theories you say online, that's something that's been at the heart of all of these conspiracy theories that have been circulating online. People really are worried about her. Yes, there were some people making jokes, but all of the strange ways that Kensington Palace press office responded to the media. And then, of course, you have the Mother's Day photo that was released, and then all of the world's photo agencies put out a kill notice on it. because it had been photoshopped. You know, those sort of decisions. Yeah, you really wonder. And then, you know, they made Kate take the blame for it.
Yeah.
Which was a choice to make.
It was. I mean, I think both you and I have dealt with Kensington Palace in the past, and they always seem to have a pretty efficient operation. And you just wonder what's happened here. I mean, I guess in some senses it becomes somewhat unimportant now. But when you look back at it, you just think, what a few weeks it's been. And I guess in some ways we're all complicit in this as well. But at some point, through that whole photo scandal, if you want to still call it that, you just wonder if there was a different way for the people around her to say, we've got this for you. We've got this.
That's 100% the thing that I think we all need to remember, because there were so many missteps along the way. And there were so many times when more information could have been given to the public to sort of quell these rumors and this social media speculation that's been going on. It really reached a fever pitch. And I don't think it would have gotten to that level, you know, where you say the media might be complicit. And I think that's a very fair point. At the same time, if there had been more information given, if we had gotten absolutely any guidance on this, perhaps it wouldn't have reached this level. It's very easy, you know, to control rumors. You can feed the media little pieces of information at a time. The key issue here was this huge information void. My theory has always been, and I think seeing Kate speak today, this is, I feel this even more. My theory has been that William and Kate have been really driving this from the beginning. A press team isn't any good if you don't listen to them. And there's only so much a press team can do if their bosses say, no, we're not doing this. No, we're not doing this. We're keeping this private. Don't release a statement. Don't respond to this. And I wonder if the communications team at Kensington Palace felt like their hands were tied in a lot of ways, because William and Kate were reacting to this the way a family does, the way parents do, the way a husband does when you get this absolutely horrible news. But when you're a family in the public eye, there are different pressures and there are different expectations. And at the same time, you can totally see how those concerns might have completely been labeled irrelevant when they got this news and when they were first dealing with it.
Yeah. And also in William's case, you know, we can't forget about his mom and his long relationship with the British, with the media, period. He had just heard about his father's cancer diagnosis. It's kind of hard to imagine. It's easy to imagine that public relations was the last thing on their mind, even though as a family, I mean, William, his entire life, and Kate for decades now, have been keenly aware of what it's like to live in the public eye.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. And I think your point about William is very accurate. I think this is true for him and Harry. You know, losing their mother was the biggest defining moment in their lives. And it makes complete sense that they both, but especially in this context, it's William who's important, that William would want to protect his wife as much as possible and keep everything locked down. And knowing this news, a lot of the stories that have been coming out in retrospect make sense. You know, there have been reports that even members of Kate and William's team didn't know what was going on. It was being kept to a very small group of people. All of that makes sense now. They wanted to just have a small little bubble around them while they were dealing with this news. And I can say that from the guidance that the palace has sent out and from Kate's video, it looks like they were planning this. I think, who knows when they made the decision that they were going to announce this, but everything is there. And I think we're really going to see a change in how the media is covering this from here on out. I wouldn't be surprised if we go to no coverage except when Kensington Palace releases a statement. I think that no matter what the coverage was, media outlets around the world are feeling like, okay, she asked for privacy in the very beginning. Things got a bit out of control, but we're going to give her this privacy now.
Ellie, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Our kids are going to play together at the company picnic.
I don't think so, Billy.
Why not?
Because you're fired.
I'm fired?
Yes, it's not your fault. Your history, Billy.
There you have it. That's one of the most memorable episodes of one of my favorite TV shows, Cheers, when Norm is... made to fire people, right? I mean, they bring him, he essentially does that for each and every one. By the end of it, the person being fired feels sorry for the fact that he does it till in fact he just doesn't have it in him anymore. So it's one of those famous episodes of Cheers from back in the day. Any of us who have been let go from a job in any way, and I have, know all too well that there is no easy way to hear that news, and obviously no easy way to share that news or to give that news. It is devastating in more ways than one. The impacts can be very long lasting, but perhaps you've had the decision explained to you. Maybe that small personal touch could ease that impact somewhat, not much, but at least you know you weren't just a number, that someone took the time to sit down with you as an employee, recognize the work that you had done, and explain why you were being let go. As we move to more remote work these days, we're also seeing what could be called an unfortunate trend towards more and more, shall we call them, impersonal layoffs, taking the sort of human out of human resources. Take that story that emerged about Bell this week. The union representing hundreds of workers let go by the telecom giant this week says that it was done in a 10-minute group virtual meeting by two managers who read a prepared statement. They then left the staff being fired on mute so there could be no questions or feedback. It's a move the union called, quote, beyond shameful. However, it is also not beyond common in this virtual work world to be hired and fired virtually as well. Some staff suddenly find themselves locked out of access to company communication tools before a Zoom meeting to inform them that they're getting the axe. Others find out by email. I'm sure that's happened to lots of people out there. But is there a risk in making these kinds of life-altering labor decisions without actually having to come face-to-face with the impact of those who are being affected by the decision? Let's bring in Alexandra Samuel. She's an authority on remote work and the digital workplace and a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal. Her book is called Remote Inc., How to Thrive at Work Wherever You Are. Alexandra, always a pleasure. Welcome back.
Hi, Ken. Nice talking to you.
I suppose we actually didn't talk about this much when we first used to talk a lot about the idea of remote work. We never actually talked about remote out of work. In other words, remote layoffs. But here they've come up once again. What was your reaction to that move by Bell this week?
Well, you know, it's hard not to cringe when you hear about people being laid off over a video call, right? Just at a human level, it seems so cruel and such a hard way for people to go through that experience.
Yeah, especially with everyone on mute. I mean, that was sort of the, I guess there's an idea that when your job is coming to an end, the company that you work for, and this may be some rose-colored glasses, but that the company you work with at least owe you an explanation for the amount of time you put in. And that, I mean, I guess legally that just isn't the case, but at least not in person, but that there has to be some sort of human contact in that human resource interaction.
Well, I think that's right. I think we have a little bit of a romanticized idea that we can offer people, you know, some sense of closure, resolution, some clarification. When you're doing these large mass layoffs, that is perhaps a tall order. And I think the other, you know, thing we have to keep in mind is, you know, to my mind, the worst case exit, and I've seen this happen, right, is in the olden days when we all still worked in offices and somebody would come into work, be literally like mad at the door, taken into HR, and then escorted back to their desk to pack up because it's a security risk, of course. You don't want people to have access to company systems once they've been laid off. But the spectacle of a person being escorted to their desk is agonizing. And, you know, equally, I think it's agonizing when you don't even have that moment. And it's just like the person is, you know, has been raptured out of their job. Nobody mentions it. They're just gone. So I think in some ways, the virtual layoff is preferable to the in-office, you know, it's not exactly a walk of shame, but that very public security escorted exit. What I think is difficult for people is, as you say, not having an opportunity to find out the whys and whens. And, you know, the only thing I guess is if it's a mass layoff situation, you know, it's not personal. And yet when it's a mass layoff that has left 8 out of 10 people in your department untouched, you kind of want to know why you were one of the two.
Yeah, no, I was thinking when this was coming up this week that the idea of having to go back to your desk with your and put your stuff in a little cardboard box and walk out the door with everyone watching isn't much better than having to sit through a particularly brutal Zoom call. But it strikes me though that one of the things that this is just all part of that process that we're going through to try to adapt to the way remote work works, that in fact it is easy. For if you're an HR department and you have to execute layoffs, the easiest way to do it is to call up a big Zoom meeting and then just do it there. Why not? Right? It's efficient, sadly.
Well, and you know, this question of how you balance the efficiency from the employer side with the humanity from the employee side is going to be more and more important in the years ahead because, you know, sadly, I do think AI is going to lead to quite a lot of dislocation. I'm optimistic that people will find new careers, but we are going to be going through a number of years of major restructuring. And the way that restructuring unfolds and the way you let people go can actually have a huge impact on how they move forward in their careers, right? And, you know, a layoff, a job loss is a traumatic event for many people, right? You often see, you know, depression, other, you know, personal crises that follow on a job loss. And so I just think, like, as an employer, you know, how can you maximize the odds that your employee is going to be able to move forward and find their next job successfully? You know, your goal should not just be, you know, how quickly can I make this happen with the smallest headcount and investment? Your goal should also be, how do we do this in a way that respects what these folks have contributed to our organization and sets them up for the next stage of their career?
Yeah, you make an interesting point. There could be a time where you don't even have another human being on the other side of that Zoom call, right? It's the AI bot telling you what you need to know.
Well, and to be honest, like, what would you prefer? Would you rather a one-way conversation where you're one of 4,000 employees being told by a human that you no longer have a job with no opportunity to ask questions? Or would you rather have a conversation with an AI that actually has your employment file, actually understands why the decision was made, and can answer questions for you? It's not an obvious answer to me which one of those I would prefer.
Yeah, we're entering into some pretty uncharted territory here. This is not the first time this has happened, though, I gather. I mean, there's just been quite a few layoffs these days in organizations where remote work was fairly commonplace, right? And,
yes.
And I guess that's why we're now bumping into this whole issue about how is that supposed to work?
Yes. Well, I mean, it's not new at all. I mean, how long ago was that movie Up in the Air where, you know, George Clooney is doing these virtual layoffs? That's his job, right? That's you know, virtual layoffs have been around for a while, and mass layoffs, you know, we saw them at McDonald's, we saw them at Meta, lots of organizations have done this. I think it might, you know, this particular Bell layoff, I wonder, you know, Bell is kind of an iconic company in Canada, and I think these, particularly given the sense of precarity in the job market, the sense that we're heading into a new era where employment is going to be restructured. It's a little scary to think about employers being able to make these decisions with so little personal footprint. And I do think that one, it's funny, right? Like, we have this conversation about layoffs as if it's the, you know, invisible hand of the market. And in some sense it is, because so much of this is driven by, you know, perceived shareholder value. But the invisible hand of the market has until now been executed by an actual human being who has to look another human being in the eye. And that creates a certain friction and a cost to laying people off that, you know, I think is healthy, right? You want employers to sort of think twice before laying people off. You don't want it to be so easy that, you know, if you don't know what to do with someone this quarter, you might as well lay them off. Like, you kind of want organizations to be willing to ride some ups and downs with their workforce without immediately trying to shed headcount. And that, I think, has changed in the workforce over the years, and fewer organizations, you know, are willing to make that even that medium term investment in their employees.
Yeah, that whole notion of loyalty as well, that if you invest in them, they'll invest in you. And if people outside of this round of layoffs see that, I suspect that it creates an environment where people wonder whether you're going to be, if they watch their colleagues get laid off this way, they're going to wonder if they're not next. And if it's, you know, if it's that impersonal, then I think there's a bond that's broken there.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a lot of attention now to the idea of an employer brand, right? And a lot of recognition that an employee experience is directly connected to a customer experience. If you have anxious, unhappy, frustrated employees, they're going to be hard pressed to deliver great service to your customers. And the companies that really shine in customer service are often the companies that do a fantastic job of treating their own employees well, because then those employees feel, you know, empowered and happy to be ambassadors for the brand. And, you know, the reality is that your employee experience is not just the experience of your current employees, it's also what your employees witness. And, you know, having worked in organizations that had that sort of rapture approach to layoffs, where you would, you know, say to someone, hey, you know, I haven't seen Chris in a while, and it would turn out Chris had been laid off 3 weeks ago and you didn't know. You know, it was a very uneasy situation, right? And you don't feel, it's hard to build trust with colleagues when you don't even know who's going to disappear without you knowing. And so I think that creating a culture of layoffs that's respectful and that keeps the larger workforce in the loop is really important in having your employees know that that you care about their experience and that you're all kind of on the same team. And I think, you know, most people recognize that, you know, economies ebb and flow. Companies do sometimes have to restructure. Individual people sometimes are not a fit or are not in a role that is needed anymore. And hiding that discomfort creates a lot of mistrust, whereas acknowledging, like, gosh, we hate having to lay people off. This is really uncomfortable. We feel like we've let the team down by not keeping an eye on finances or not anticipating the next bend in the road. You know, that's what gives people more of a sense of confidence in their team.
Alexandra Samuel is an authority on remote work and the digital workplace. She writes for the Wall Street Journal. Her book is called Remote Inc. Alexandra, I guess part of the issue here is we're just figuring out this whole to and fro between remote work and the employer, right? And some of the, there's going to be some missteps, right? Obviously there's been missteps around trying to figure out how to keep people, you know, how to account for people's hours when they're supposed to be at work. There's been several missteps when it comes to laying people off. So I guess we're just, again, somewhat at the beginning of all this, but what would be the right alternative then to, I mean, you would think that one-on-one calls might be the only way to, I mean, there's no easy way to be laid off. And I guess for HR people, there's no easy way to lay people off. But one-on-one would seem to be the answer here.
Well, you know, one-on-one would be preferable, but probably not realistic at scale.
True right? enough, like, true enough.
Like, do you have 400 skilled HR people who can do concurrent layoffs? And, you know, you do need to think about what the alternatives are, particularly in the age of social media, because even if you have, you know, 15-minute time slots and you're going one-on-one and you've got, you know, therefore you can get through 50 people in a day, by the time you get to the 40th person, the first 10 people are tweeting, they're posting, they're calling, they're texting. Sure. And I'm not sure if I'm an employee that I want to hear about this from a colleague before I hear about it for myself. And you also, you know, do have the security risk of all those people, you know, waiting for the axe to fall while they're still on your network. And so if you cut them off the network, then you've essentially let them know without letting them know. So, you know, to my mind, the big mistake here is in that one-way call. I mean, this isn't 1972. It's not like keeping the call on mute means that those employees have no way of sharing their upset and their distress and their questions. There's this thing called Facebook. There's this thing called Instagram. There's this thing called, apparently it's now called X. There are a lot of platforms where people, you know, can and do share their displeasure. So like, if I'm Bell, I would, you know, yes, you're going to end up with a very, very miserable group of people screaming at you on Zoom. But wouldn't you rather have people scream at you on Zoom for an hour than, you know, complain about you in public where your customers are seeing you for the next 2 months?
Yes, I think that's why we landed on this. Alexander Samuel, as always, have a great weekend. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope next time we can talk about a happier situation in the new workplace.
I'm sure we will. Hopefully. Thanks again.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.